John Daly here. You know what day it is?
Neither do I.
I live life daily. That's why I only spin on Moto Casino. Moto's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily. And the best part? Guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Moto. America's social casino. Play for free on Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Hello and welcome back to Epochs, where I shall be continuing my story of the life and career of King Henry V of England. If you remember last time we left off, he was just about to embark for the great campaign of 1415 and he'd just thwarted the Southampton plot. So I'll pick up the story straight from there. Today I'll be largely reading, or entirely reading, from a book by Ian Mortimer just called 1415. It was a book that came out in about 2010. And I read it back then and thought it was excellent. And what this particular book does is it goes through in crazy detail, granular detail, brilliant detail if you're interested in it. It's almost day by day. It's all done chronologically, and not every single day has got an entry, but most of the days he's saying something about it. So it's really drilling down into it. And when I read this, like, God, best part of 15 years ago now, I loved it so much. And I've been rereading it for this bit because I want to go into the campaign of 1415 in tons and tons of detail, and there's no better book that I've ever read about it than Ian Mortimer. So I'm going to read quite a lot today from this one. Okay, so before I start, a few words then about the numbers involved. So basically, he's got about 15,000 fighting men, but there's a lot more people involved than that. Maybe twice as many, because he's got lots of mariners, sailors, and then lots of non-combatants. So lots of people that are like carpenters, miners, sappers, cooks, pages, servants, lots of prostitutes, lots and lots of people that come along for the ride, even though there weren't supposed to be any prostitutes. Henry had specifically said not to have any of those. But so there'll be something in the order of 30,000 people crossing the channel, but only about half of those are actual soldiers or combatants. Still, that's quite a lot for this day and age. The very, very early 15th century. Remember, the Black Death isn't all that long ago. It's only sort of 60 years ago. So the whole world's population is much smaller than it used to be. And anyway, just in the sort of higher Middle Ages, early Middle Ages-ish time, an army of 15,000 is absolutely not to be sniffed at. It seems like a small number to conquer all of France. It seems like a disastrously small number, but it's actually quite big. Like, the fleet to carry them across the channel to Harfleur is either 1,500 or 1,600 ships. They'll be quite small ships. There'll be one or two big ships, but most of them will be pretty small. You know, they'll hold 10 men and 10 horses. Oh, that's the other thing. There'll be almost as many horses as there are combatants. So it's actually, logistically, physically speaking, quite an undertaking. It takes a long time for Henry to assemble this fleet. Even though everything's ready on the south coast of England, it still takes a couple of days to get them all in one spot, more or less, one harbour, basically, or two harbours, to jump across the channel to Harfleur. Even that, mustering them together in one place, takes two or three days. But then when they do cross the channel, luckily there's no big storms. It's August, it's early August, 1415. There's no big storm. Not many ships, or no real ships, I think, are lost to the weather. But a couple of them do burn down, just by accident, burn down to the waterline. So I'll let Ian Mortimer pick up the story from when they sort of first appear. This fleet, this giant war fleet, appears to the French on Tuesday, the 13th of August, 1415. Mortimer says this, quote, "It was the fishermen off the coast of Boulogne who first noticed the fleet approaching the French coast. The region around their town had been ransacked over recent days by the English of Calais," because the English still controlled Calais. So they were able to chevauchee across from Calais to Harfleur, or Boulogne anyway, and start doing damage. So they, the people of Boulogne, were alert to the danger. But one imagines that they looked at the huge fleet in the channel with considerable alarm, especially if they believed that it was heading to their own town. The men of Boulogne were lucky. Henry was heading elsewhere. At about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, Trinity Royal, that's the biggest Royal Navy ship, the one Henry himself is on. There's kind of two really big ships. When I say big, they're still only got a crew of like about 100 men, 100 plus men. So, you know, it's big for those days, really big. But, you know, compared to modern standards, it's still really small. You know, when you look at things like the Golden Hind or the Mary Rose, compared to modern standards, they're still tiny. But anyway, Trinity Royal is the flagship, the royal flagship of the Navy. So about 5 o'clock in the afternoon on Tuesday, the 13th of August, 1415, Trinity Royal sailed into the mouth of the Seine. Because another thing to say is that Harfleur is at the mouth of a couple of rivers, particularly the Seine, which is the river that runs through Paris. So if you want to eventually take Paris, which ultimately is the goal, then technically, strategically, the thing to do is to secure the Seine and the mouth of the Seine, where the Seine empties into the Atlantic or the Channel. You're going to want to hold that. You don't want the enemy to be holding that, so you've got no means of retreat by water if needs be. So that's why he picked Harfleur. It's not just random. Also, Harfleur had been a site of lots of piracy from the French point of view. So in order to stop that, in order to secure the Channel 100%, it was just sort of obvious, sort of a no-brainer that he has to take Harfleur. We'll put a map up so you can see sort of exactly what I'm talking about there. So the Trinity Royal sailed into the mouth of the Seine and dropped anchor near a small hamlet called Chef de Coe, about 3 miles from the walls of Harfleur on the north bank of the Seine estuary. The banner of the council was unfurled on a Trinity Royal, calling all the councillors to a meeting. It was decided that a royal proclamation would be issued to all the ships, forbidding anyone on pain of death from landing on French soil before the king himself, unless they had the king's express permission. Everyone was to prepare to land early on the following morning. If the men dispersed in search of plunder or women, the captains of the army were liable to lose control. There was also the heavy risk of men in small groups being picked off by French defenders. Henry had no need to take such risks at this stage of the campaign. A group of men were selected to go ashore that night and to reconnoitre the immediate vicinity. Henry chose the hugely experienced Sir John Cornwall and Cornwall's brother-in-arms, William Poulter, King's Esquire, the Cornwall's stepson, the young and talented Earl of Huntingdon. With them went Sir Gilbert Umfraville and John Steward and a number of mounted men-at-arms. Prior information from the men who had travelled through Harfleur over the preceding year led Henry to believe that there was a hill nearby, Mont Le Comte, on which it would be suitable to make a first camp. The expedition was to explore the area and establish first whether there were Frenchmen guarding this hill. Second, they were to find a suitable place for quartering the royal household. They went ashore in the early hours and were basically unopposed. It was something of a surprise, not a complete surprise, because the French had spies in England. Both sides had spies all over the place. Henry had spies in Paris. So they were aware that something was happening. They just didn't know exactly the size of it. They didn't know exactly where it was going to land. And there were no sort of Atlantic wall defences up and down all of northern France. So basically, Henry's landing was completely uncontested. Okay, Wednesday the 14th, the next morning, when they all come ashore. Henry's attitude to the landing suggests a high state of anxiety. This is entirely understandable. He had 15,000 men and probably twice as many mariners in an extremely vulnerable position. Years of planning, preparation and reconnaissance were being put to the test. Cautious all the way through, he waited until Cornwall, Poulter and Huntingdon had returned before he began to plan his own landing. Those in the ships around him looked at the beach where they were expected to land. They felt uneasy, as the author of the Gesta Henrici Quinti noted. So now we get words, literally 600-year-old words now of what happened from a history written more or less at the time. We're told, the shore was very stony, with large boulders against which the ships were liable to be dashed, and with other smaller stones, pebbles handy for throwing, with which the enemy, had they wished to oppose our landing, could have attacked us and defended themselves. And at the back of the shore, between us and the land, deep ditches had been dug that were full of water, and behind these, earth walls of great thickness, furnished with ramparts and angles in the manner of a tower or castle, and between every two ditches the ground was left intact for the breadth of a cubit, permitted only one man at a time to enter or leave. Ian Mortimer continues, the site had been chosen because it was thought to be left unguarded, but there was a good reason why. It was very difficult to land a large force here. A few ships could unload quickly, maybe, but 1,500? The whole process would take such a long time. About a mile away, to the south of Harfleur, there were fewer stones, but that was no easier a landing place, as there was a marsh there that led far inland, with ditches and gullies. The narrow tracks through that marsh would have allowed a few men to hold up several thousand. Henry and his men took to the barges, quote, between the 6th and 7th hour, which in this case probably means 6 to 7 a.m., reckoning from midnight. When Henry landed, he fell to his knees and prayed that he might do justice on his enemies. This gesture may have been a spontaneous act, or it may have been a deliberate emulation of his predecessors. If you remember a lot of the earlier epochs, I will have mentioned exactly this happening. I happen to think that Henry V was doing it deliberately, but Immortal tells us about all the predecessors where this happened. It is worth remembering that Edward III had fallen on landing in Normandy on the Crecy campaign and declared it a welcome embrace from the Kingdom of France. This in turn was probably a deliberate emulation of William the Conqueror, who had fallen on landing in England in 1066 and got up with his hands full of sand, declaring he held the Kingdom of England in his hands. Also in emulation of past practice, Henry knighted a number of men there on the beach, among them William Porter, Thomas Guiney, John Calthrop and John Radcliffe, just as Edward III had knighted his son and other men on landing in 1346. Following these ceremonies, he was quickly led to the Mont Le Comte, where his priests were able to celebrate Mass and where the army would camp. For the French in the vicinity, there was no question of resisting such a large army, although the English feared attack and knew they were hugely vulnerable as they stepped ashore. To stop them would have required a large force of men to be ready to intercept them, which they just simply didn't have. The nearest such force, as the crow flies, was one of 1,500 men commanded by Charles d'Albret at Honfleur, which is pretty close to Harfleur, but a different place, Honfleur, on the south side of the Seine. Boucicourt, that's a man, Boucicourt was on the north side of the river, but at Cordebec, about 25 miles to the east. He also had about 1,500 men, too few to tackle the English after they had become to come ashore in large numbers. As for Harfleur itself, there were at most only two small forces present. 100 men-at-arms under Jean, Seigneur de Esteville, and 34 men-at-arms in the town, under the command of Leonette de Bracamont, Olivier de Bracamont, and John Bouffriel, together with a small number of crossbowmen under Roland de Guerel. I may be butchering a lot of these French names. In fact, I am butchering a lot of these French names. These forces could hardly take on an army of more than 11,000 fighting men. 300 more men-at-arms were mustering on this very day, commanded by the redoubtable knight Raoul de Gaucourt. This Raoul de Gaucourt becomes important in the Siege of Harfleur, so remember that name. But they were still more than 3 days' march away from Harfleur. What defensive precautions had already been undertaken were due to the townsmen themselves. Apart from the possibility that de Gaucourt might yet reach the town before the blockade started, the people of Harfleur and the small garrison were on their own. Thursday the 15th, which was the Feast of the Assumption. The problems posed by the landing site meant that it would take several days for all the men, horses, equipment and provisions to be taken off the ships. As thousands of men moved in and around the beach and up the hill to the tents, Henry probably relocated himself to the Priory of Graville. Perhaps it was in the church here that he celebrated the Feast of the Assumption. Outside, the burning and looting had already started. Pigs, geese and hens were taken, granaries and houses robbed and burnt. The Englishmen, all with the Red Cross of St. George painted on their surcoats, scattered quickly, searching for plunder. After a week of being restricted within small ships, they revelled in being on dry land and able to take what they wanted from the country that they had come to destroy. Friday the 16th of August. Henry had been gathering information on Harfleur for months. Members of his first embassy in 1414 had travelled to France via Harfleur, including Bishop Courtenay, also another quite important figure to remember, Bishop Courtenay, the Earl of Salisbury and Lord Grey. As we have seen, certain members of the recent embassy had also travelled that way, namely Sir William Bourchier, Sir John Phillip and William Porter. And these were just the ambassadors who had passed through Harfleur. There must have been many other men besides. So Henry knew more or less what to expect when he looked down over the town and port from the hill to the west. Harfleur was a medium-sized town with a population of about 5,000 people. A high 2.5-mile stone wall, punctuated by 24 watchtowers and surrounded by ditches, encircled the Church of St. Martin, the public buildings and houses of the citizens. The wall also enclosed Le Clos de Glacy, an inner fortified naval port whose walls were higher even than those of the town itself. The river Lézard ran down from the north, so two rivers converge at Harfleur, the Seine itself and another one, the Lézard. The river Lézard ran down from the south and divided into two. I mean, it's kind of an estuary region, really. One part ran around the western wall of the town like a deep moat. The other ran through sluices in the town walls, through the centre of the town itself, and into Le Clos de Glacis. This guaranteed a water supply in a siege and gave power to two mills just inside the walls. There were three gates, the Porte Lure on the west, the Porte Montivilliers on the north, and the Porte Rouen on the southeast. Two large towers guarded the water gate leading to the Clos de Glacis. These could raise a great chain between them, preventing the entry of any ships. To the south, on either side of the Lézard, the town was protected by the marshes that ran down to the sea. These were the same marshes that the English attackers had noticed while waiting to disembark on the rocky shore further to the west. Not everything was familiar to Henry. Some changes had recently taken place. Around each of the three gates, substantial barbicans or bulwarks had been built. These were circular enclosures of tree trunks lashed together and part buried in the ground, strengthened with earth mounds and surrounded by water-filled moats. So sort of strong points, really, these barbicans. They had spaces in them for small cannon and crossbows to fire at approaching attackers. The road to Montivilliers had been in part taken up, ripped up, and the stones taken into the town to use in the town's catapults. The river approach to the town had been blocked with sharpened stakes below the waterline. Most worrying of all, the sluice gates had been closed on the north, flooding the entire valley. To go around in order to attack the town on the east side now required a journey of 9 or 10 miles. But Henry had set himself upon a path. Since April, he had described the expedition's first aim as seizing Harfleur. It was a matter of pride that he would do what he set out to do. He ordered the houses in the suburbs to be burnt and the whole area to be cleared, ready for his siege engines and cannon. The attack would begin the following day. So that's one thing to mention, sort of perhaps strategically. It might have been worth, when they actually turned up there and realised that Harfleur, although not infested with a giant garrison, was very well defended. I mean, Shakespeare calls it strongly girded Harfleur, you know, well defended Harfleur. Its wall was no joke. Its various defences, everything from flooding the area deliberately to building extra barricades and extra earthworks and extra strong points, barbicans, everything there, it looked like, well, it was a difficult town to take, really quite difficult. Strategically, it might have been worth reconsidering. It might have been worth forgetting about Harfleur and just start chevaucheting through northern France, Edward III style, or heading straight towards Rouen, or straight towards Paris, or straight towards the French army, wherever it was, whenever it would muster in force. It might have been worth, you know, giving up on the idea of Harfleur entirely. But as Mortimer mentioned there, Henry was kind of stubborn or prideful. He'd said he was going to do this and he wasn't going to be put off at the first hurdle. So he decides to start the siege. And, you know, spoiler alert, it's not a particularly quick one. It's not a crazily long one. Some sieges last years and years and years, particularly in the ancient world. Well, even in the modern world, pre-modern world, medieval world, sometimes sieges could last years. If you realise you couldn't break in and you have to sort of starve the town or the city out, it could take years. So, you know, this siege of Harfleur we're talking about here, it doesn't take years and years, but it's not over within days. Henry needed it to be over quickly. He needed it to be over within days or, you know, a few weeks at most. Well, it's not as smooth as that. Okay, Ian Mortimer continues. It's now Saturday the 17th of August. The final provisions, horses and equipment were unloaded from the ships and the siege began. Henry divided his army into three battles or battalions in order to facilitate organisation. His own battle was centrally positioned, facing the Porte Lure. The other two were established on his flanks, probably commanded by the Dukes of Clarence and York. The actual order of events thereafter is not easy to determine. In all likelihood, Henry set a higher priority in bringing up the cannon and the siege engines from the coast. At least one great gun, Good Grace, and one siege engine was positioned directly opposite the Porte Lure and its barbican. He held a council to determine the best way of attacking the town and of supplying the soldiers who were now encamped in the fields to the west. Groups of men were sent out to find food in the villages and farms nearby. They quickly covered a huge area. A 28-year-old priest from Harfleur, Raoul Legay, was captured by an English foraging party on the road 7 miles east of Harfleur. He was taken back to Saint-Yvic, 3 miles from the main army, and told by a French-speaking English knight that he would be ransomed for 100 crowns. Unfortunately for him, he could not pay. The English decided to take him to the main camp at Graville. It appears likely that it was today that Henry issued his military ordinances, the set of codes and conduct for the campaign. These had been issued to armies since at least Edward III's campaign in 1346, when an edict had stated that, and here's the original wording, no town or manor was to be burnt, no church or holy place sacked, and no old people, children or women in this kingdom of France were to be harmed or molested, nor were the soldiers to threaten people or to do any kind of wrong on pain of life and limb. Whether all the soldiers abided by that is another story. Of course, not all of them did, but there you go. That was the ordinance. Well, that was an Edward III era ordinance, but Henry V's were similar. Ian Mortimer continues. For Henry to attack in France and yet to be seen as the leader of a moral war, he needed to do his best to control the more violent and less humane tendencies of his soldiers. The military ordinances were proclaimed by the captains of the army, and copies were to be given to the captains to ensure that they were obeyed. Various versions of the ordinances issued by Henry V over the years, between 1415 and 1421, are extant, meaning they still survive, we've still got them. The set most likely to have been issued in August 1415 is known by historians as Upton's Ordinances. There were 14 sections, the first being to protect churches and religious buildings and not to steal from them, and to protect the Eucharist and the pyx, and the second, not to capture or harm any clergymen or women, or to take prisoner any clergymen unless they were armed and hostile, and not to rape any women on pain of death. The third section stipulated that everyone in the army, including merchants and other non-combatants riding with the army, should obey without question any order from the king and constable and the marshal of the army. The fourth section specified how the nighttime watch was to be maintained, with the constable and marshal again in charge. The fifth ordered captains to be ready to muster their men-at-arms and archers whenever the king or his officers required, on pain of arrest and forfeiture of arms and horse. And the sixth was designed to prevent insurrection and loss of control within the army. For instance, no one was to, quote, cry havoc, havoc being the order by which men on the battlefield could break ranks and steal whatever they wanted. And no one was to, quote, cry Montez or horse, or other cries that might bring danger to the whole host. No one was to let old feuds and duels govern their conduct in the camp, i.e. between themselves. And no matter what news came to the army, no one was to break ranks. So discipline was sort of the order of the day. The remainder of the ordinances were similarly intended to strengthen the army through discipline. No one was to ride out from the host without permission or to go foraging ahead on their own. No one was to raise a banner or pennon of St. George to lead a group of men away from the main army, nor to go ahead of the host under a banner unless he was a messenger. No one was to burn any buildings without special command of the king. If anyone found victuals, or food basically, or wine, he should take only enough for himself and not destroy the remainder, but leave it for the army. Men were not to rob each other of any victuals they found or otherwise receive. No one except the king, constable or marshal was to give safe conduct to anyone from outside the army. Particular ordinances treated the problem of prisoners. For most soldiers, the main lure of war was the attraction of wealth, to be gained not by looting, or largely not by looting, but by taking and ransoming important men. So that's a massive part of war in this period. If you can take an important man prisoner, you ransom him back to his own family or his own household for quite a lot of money. Well, as much money as you can extort out of them, really. Hence, disputes often arose over who had taken whom prisoner. It was now made clear that there were to be no disputes over captives, nor over weapons, coats of arms, or lodgings. Grooms and pages who got involved in such arguments were to have their left ear cut off. When a man took a prisoner, he was to take his helmet and gauntlets as a sign that his victim was already claimed. Two men who collectively defeated a knight could share the rights and subsequent ransom. It was clearly anticipated that, in the heat of battle, rivalries between men could lead to one trying to kill the other's prisoner. This was forbidden. The killing of a man who was trying to submit was similarly not allowed. No man was to sell his prisoner or to ransom him without the king's permission, and everyone who took prisoners was liable to pay his lord one third of the eventual ransom. There was one last moral ordinance in this sect, and it is very revealing of Henry's attitude to women of easy virtue and his view of sex. Although earlier English kings had tolerated prostitutes in the royal household, Henry had a much stricter moral view. He prohibited any women from staying in the camp at all, or even being located nearer than 3 miles. His ordinance laid down that the first time a woman was found in the camp, she was to be warned. The second time, she was to have her left arm broken, end quote. Oh, okay. It's often the way, even right up to sort of the 18th, 19th century, particularly in the Navy, that you couldn't really, you know, for example, bring women aboard a ship. As certain women, you know, old fishwives and cooks and washermaids are one thing, but young pretty women that are obviously sort of prostitutes that are going to be sort of passed round, it's like a big problem. You really, the senior brass really don't want that. It's sort of, in their mind anyway, it sort of ruins the men's fighting ability. But often they just sneaked in anyway. I mean, very, very often. It's like, you know, you're not supposed to have drugs or sort of grain alcohol in prison, but it always gets in anyway. The prisoners will make their own anyway. The soldiers will find a way to smuggle prostitutes in anyway. For example, even in the age of sort of Nelson, in the 18th century, it's like a big ship stowed away somewhere below decks will be a prostitute. Ian Mortimer continues saying this, quote, "In his pavilion, the Duke of York sealed his last will and testament. Like Henry IV and Henry V himself, he adopted the self-demeaning language of extreme abasement. The document, which was in French, began." So now again, we get the words from 600 years ago. The Duke of York's will read, "In the name of God Almighty, and the Son, and the Holy Ghost, and the Holy Trinity, and the glorious Virgin, Our Lady St. Mary, and St. Thomas, our glorious martyr, and of St. Thomas, the Holy Confessor, and of all the holy saints in paradise, I, Edward of York, of all sinners, the most wicked and blameworthy." Mortimer interrupts here to say, "who desired to be buried in the chapel at Fotheringay, in the middle of the choir, near the steps, under a flat marble slab. He stipulated that his debts should be paid and the expenses of his funeral should not exceed £100, which is still loads of money in those days. His first bequest was to the king, the best sword and the best dagger I have. Next was," and then it goes back into the actual words themselves, "to my wife Philippa, my bed of feathers and leopards with the furniture that goes with it. Also my white and red tapestry of garters, feather locks and falcons, my green bed embroidered with a compass, my 2 large vessels of silver and covered basins in her keeping with the falcons and fetterlocks in the middle with a blue background." Mortimer says at this point, "those servants of his who had been in his service for a whole year before sailing for Harfleur were to be paid their wages in full for the 6 month term after his death, £2.10 to each esquire, £1 to each garçon, and half a mark," which was 6 shillings 8 pence, "to each page. All his Copelands," which were full-length, long-sleeved and high-collared gowns, "were to be delivered among the servants of his chamber and wardrobe. His saddles and harnesses were likewise to be divided among his servants. In all the masses that might be said for him, he willed that Richard II, Henry IV, his father, Edmund of York, and his mother, Isabella, should also be mentioned." He continued, "I will that all my vestments, crucifixes, images, tabernacles, basins, ewers, censers, sconces, and other jewels in my chapel, excepting the goods and jewels that I pledged to enable me to go in that voyage to France in the company of my lord the king, be after my decease given to the master and his brethren of my said college of Fotheringay, to be perpetually kept by them and their successors." Mortimer again now. "Other personal bequests included £20 to Thomas Placid, in memory of the kindness that he showed me when I was a prisoner at Pevensey, a sword, a coat of mail, and £10 in cash to Philip Beauchamp, a suit of jointed armour covered in red velvet, and £10 in money to Thomas Beauchamp, and a new suit of jointed armour covered in velvet, his helmet and his best horse to Sir John Popham." The reason why I bothered reading that bit out is just because, one, I find it very interesting, and two, that to make the point again that we've got lots and lots of detail here, really, considering it's the very beginning of the 15th century, that all these documents survive, I think, and most historians think, is, you know, quite remarkable. And so, you know, let's take advantage of them if we can. I want to paint a lot of detail for this campaign of 1415, because I find it so interesting. Lots of people that are interested in Henry V and Agincourt find it all quite fascinating. So, yeah, I'm going to go into quite a lot of detail. Hopefully you'll enjoy it. But the fact that we've got the will and testament of the Duke of York, it's fascinating stuff.
If you would like to see the full version of this premium video, please head over to lotuseaters.com and subscribe to gain full access to all of our premium content.
John Daly here. You know what day it is? Neither do I. I live life daily. That's why I only spend on Moto Casino. Moto's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily. And the best part? Guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Moto. America's social casino. Play for free on Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.